Okay, welcome to mile 23 of the marathon. This is the time. You know, it's funny. I've done these things before where I've gone and I've spoken at various places, and you go and you travel, and sometimes the 23 miles is spent on the trip. So you get an 18-hour flight somewhere, and you land, and you realize in the schedule you didn't carefully pick the time you started to speak. So you fly to Asia, or you fly to the Middle East, or you fly somewhere, and it takes you overnight to get there. You fly into tomorrow, and you realize you've been in a plane for 18 hours, only realize that you have about 6 hours of rest before you speak again. And so you do the sprint at the end of the marathon. And sometimes these sessions feel a little bit like that, only in the sense that the interaction's been so rich and the conversations have been so deep with you guys that I find myself unable to stop talking or even unable to stop listening to what you guys are having to say, and I've taken no rest for myself. But that last session was quite restful, so thank you for that. I hope the small groups were a good time for you all. I want to finish up on this topic on Is Christianity Good for the World? With an illustration of something. So there's a story. It's in a great book of a collection of stories, true stories of missionaries who go to tough areas in the world, very tough areas in the world. It's an older book, so it doesn't have a lot of contemporary stories, you know, things that happened in the 80s or 90s or whatever, but stuff that happened a while back. And the book is called Of Whom the World Was Not Worthy, you know, playing on the biblical passage that says that. It's by Marie Chapin. And she tells various stories of these various missionaries who go all over the place. And one of the stories she tells is the story of a missionary named Yaakov, Y-A-K-O-V. Now, Yaakov is just the Eastern European way to say Jacob. So he goes to the former Yugoslavia, back when there was a Yugoslavia, and it's war-torn. It's torn up. It's just a wreck because of all the factioning and the inner civil war kind of stuff and all this. Just a wreck of a place. And the problem was, of course, was that not only were there different factions that were warring and then which resulted in rape and pillaging and stealing of goods and all kind of terrible things that were happening, the problem was the clergy was involved oftentimes in some of the dastardly deeds that were going on in this area. So it was terribly, terribly polarizing and sending people away from religion altogether. So Yaakov comes into this milieu, you know, where people are not exactly up on the whole Christian thing because of the way the clergy had used the situation for their own advantage and caused the deaths and abuses of people in clergy, through their clergy and their power. So he comes to a man named Zimmerman. And Zimmerman is the guy who's had it. He's completely had it with religion. His history has just been one of abuse in every kind of way, not only from the government but also religion. And Yaakov comes and preaches with him to him the gospel. And Zimmerman says, thank you, no thank you. You can just stop right there. I have no interest in this. You know, I see these men in their fancy hats and their fancy coats, these clergy in their fancy hats and their fancy coats, but underneath all of that, they're wicked demons. My own nephew was murdered by them. I want nothing to do with this Jesus that they represent. You can forget it. And of course, Yaakov is a smart guy, and what he says is, well, let me ask you a question, Zimmerman. Let's say someone stole your hat, and someone stole your coat, and they took that, and they went to rob a bank, and they robbed this bank, and in the flurry of the activity, no one got a really good look at the man's face, but he looks similar to you, he's built similar to you, but he's wearing your hat, and he's wearing your coat. So when the authorities come, and they have your hat and their coat in their hand, because they found that, and they said, people saw you, Zimmerman, robbed that bank, what are you going to say? Of course, the implication is obvious, you know. It wasn't really me. It was someone who dressed like me, and he knows what Yaakov is saying about this. These men pretend to be Jesus, but they're just wearing the outer vestments, so don't throw out Jesus when you throw out all the dastardly deeds of these men. Zimmerman sees where he's going with this. He says, I know where you're going with this, Yaakov, but you can just forget it. Just put it away. I'm done. That's the perception now. You know, when you look out into the world right now and you look and you say, if you say these two words, especially together, evangelical Christianity, there's a reaction in this room, and most of you are evangelical Christians. There's already a reaction, you know. You see what's going on. There's a politicization of this whole thing. There's a polarization that comes with certain words. And so I go to all these universities, and the questions have shifted. You know, they've changed. It used to be you go to a university, you go and speak, and you go to speak on the four S's. You know, science, sexuality, suffering, and significance. You go and speak on those things. And they come to the microphone, and they ask the follow-up questions. And usually it was about things like, hasn't science put God out of a job? Doesn't evolution prove that there's no reason for a God to exist? We can prove it. Darwin basically gave us a reason to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist. Aren't there contradictions in the Bible? What about the historicity of the resurrection? Can you really show me why you believe the resurrection is true? You know, these kind of things. Was Lysanias really Tetrarch of Abila, as Luke says, at the time of Jesus' birth? Or was he Tetrarch of Abila 50 years beforehand and Luke just got it wrong? You know, these are the kind of things that they would ask before. Propositional truth questions. What's interesting is the questions have shifted now. Now when you go to a university, now when you go to various places where the gospel is not necessarily welcomed with open arms, the microphones are filled with people who are asking not these questions, they're asking questions like, isn't the Bible racist? Isn't the Bible sexist? Isn't the Bible homophobic, transphobic, genderphobic, all these various things? Isn't it responsible for all the colonialism in the world? Isn't it responsible for the climate change in the world? They're actually making that charge. Christianity is the reason for climate change. You know, you go on and on and on and you see these things. Here's my point. You notice what's happening is the primary questions are now, is Christianity good? They're not actually asking, is Christianity true? They're asking that eventually, but the primary question is Christianity good? They don't care if it's true or not until you can prove to them that it's actually good. So I was at MIT recently, and I spoke on this topic. Dangerous or delusional? Is Christianity good for the world? And so I wanted to speak about, does the Bible's message actually comport with our moral ethic? Do we get a sense of moral value from the biblical sense? Is it racist? Is it sexist? Or does the Bible rather justify our outrage at sexism and racism as opposed to naturalism, which gives you no basis for that outrage? So I gave that part of the talk. I also gave the delusional talk. Is it delusional? Or do we have good reason, scientific and philosophical and otherwise, to believe in the Christian faith? So those were the two things I talked about. Dangerous, moral, delusional, factual. All the questions from the top people, the most brilliant minds in the world, who come to the most prestigious technical college in the world to talk about science and all these issues, not one science question. Not one. You can go on our YouTube channel. You can go see at All Rise. Our YouTube channel and you'll see the dialogue. You'll see the open forum there. Not one question was on science. All of them were on different religions, morality, and sexuality, and moral value. And the discussions I had afterwards with the students, hours and hours long with these students, were all about the nature of morality and the nature of sexuality and the nature of human value. Fascinating. These are the top questions. These are the questions where if we're listening carefully, we know we don't need to answer, here's 15 reasons why the Bible's true, because they're not even asking that question. If we let our speech be gracious and seasoned with salt, we'll answer the questions they're actually asking, not the one we hope they ask. So let me dive into it, because here's some things that they see. Here's what the culture sees. We have to be honest with these things. We have to be honest with the issues. If we whitewash or blanket or sanitize, whatever it is we do to make the Christendom's history less onerous or less odious, we do a disservice to people, because they can find out pretty quickly that you're not telling the truth, or at least you're telling the version of history that you'd like to be true. So years ago, maybe 2 years ago, I can't remember when it was, I was in Charleston, South Carolina for an event. And I've never been to Charleston. If you've been to Charleston, you know it's gorgeous there. It's beautiful, especially sort of in the spring. It's just gorgeous. And you also know that there's a history to Charleston. Charleston is the place where the Civil War started, Fort Sumter and all this stuff. Now, when you go to Charleston, there's something really interesting about Charleston. There's an ordinance, a city ordinance, I think still in effect today, where no building can be built higher than the tallest church in Charleston. The steeple of the tallest church in Charleston is quite tall, and no building in Charleston can be built higher than that steeple. In other words, the cross is elevated above all other things in Charleston, South Carolina. Same exact city, at the same exact time that ordinance was in force, had a slave market. So how do you juxtapose a city that vaunts the cross so high and debases people for whom Christ died so low? How do you reconcile the contradiction that you see between these two things and expect people to say, that's the religion for me? That's the worldview for me. Everything's crystal clear. Is it? Or do we have a history of an abuse of this system that turns people into property at the same time we make the cross the highest thing in the place? We have to reckon with this. We can't just gloss over this. We have to reckon with this. We have to do it. Then you see what's going on now. You know, the Barbie movie. I know that in this room, there's likely a lot of people saw it. I saw it, by the way, on purpose, and was not dragged to it. It was my idea. Here's why. The Barbie movie was a social phenomenon that happened where everybody needed to go. It was all about the patriarchy. You know, so I hear the whole hullabaloo about the Barbie movie, and my ministry comments on social issues. So I'm like, well, I have to watch this thing. I have a boy and two girls. It matters very much to me how it is that human beings see my daughters. It matters very much to me and how they are able to succeed in this world without being second-class citizens. So I want to go see this movie, you know, and see what all the hullabaloo's about. So I did drag my wife. This is ironic. She didn't drag me. I dragged her to this thing. And we sat down, and she fell asleep within the credits. Opening credits, she fell asleep. No use for this kind of a thing. I pull out my phone and start taking notes. So I'm this creepy guy at the Barbie movie taking notes on the thing. But I wanted to know what it's all about, you know. And of course, the word patriarchy is used all over the place in the movie. They talk about the patriarchy as if it's some kind of a disease you can catch. In fact, there's a scene in the movie where, I don't know if you know the premise of the movie, it's ridiculous, but Barbie and Ken in the Barbie and Ken world somehow figure out a way to cross over into the real world, and Ken is considered a second-class citizen in Barbie land because he was made for Barbie. And of course, there's a obvious like dig at the Bible because, you know, Eve was made for Adam kind of a thing. So Ken comes over and sees men are in control of everything here. And so he catches patriarchy. And he brings it back to Barbie land, and all the Barbies that are there, they all basically start submitting to men because, and they even describe it, they say, the Barbies have no inoculation to it. It's like when we brought the plague or we brought smallpox into indigenous peoples in the North America and South America. They all died because they had no immunity from it. And so the Barbies didn't have any immunity from patriarchy, so they caught patriarchy. And so I wrote a whole article. It's on Fox News, actually. If you want to go and look at my article on Fox News, you can see my article on the Barbie movie. It's interesting to me. So the word patriarchy is specifically used because it actually takes a dig at the Bible because of the patriarchs and the importance of the patriarchs. So this is the way the culture is looking at these things and seeing these things and saying this word patriarch or patriarchy automatically is a bad word. It's equated with disease. So now we have to deal with that. And then, of course, there's the sexuality question. I do want to touch on this as well, because much of what's going on right now is either about transphobia or about homophobia or anything that precedes the word phobia and laid at the feet of evangelical Christianity, because we, frankly, don't have that great of a record in dealing with people who are struggling with various sexual issues. So we need to unpack these things, and I want to do it piece by piece, if we could. So I do want to turn right away and speak about the race issue and the ethnicity issue. And the first thing that I have to deal with when doing this is speak about the Bible and slavery. We have to deal with this. Now, this sounds like a shameless plug for my books, but I wrote them so people would read them. And I don't know if you guys know this, but every single dollar of the royalties goes to Feeds Hungry Children. But they happen to be my children. I stole that joke and probably shouldn't tell it because I made you very impressed with me only to make you find out I'm not that great of a guy. But in More Than a White Man's Religion, I go through the details of some of the quote-unquote troubling passages of the Bible because there are passages of the Bible that seem to suggest that it promotes slavery. Now, when I say the word slavery, the first thing you think of is antebellum Southern slavery or the transatlantic slave trade. That's the first thing you think of. Maybe human trafficking today, but in our context in America, that's the first thing you think of is transatlantic slave trade, which was race-based chattel slavery. Now, that's a fancy word essentially for this. Chattel is a legal term. It means anything that is property. So race-based chattel slavery is slavery where you don't own the services of a person, you own the actual person as property. And in the transatlantic slave trade, and of course slavery as practiced in both Europe and in the United States, it was race-based. Yes, there were non-black slaves, non-African slaves in the slavery system, but by and large, let's not sugarcoat it, it was race-based. It just was. And so when you see the word slavery in the Bible, the first thing you think of is that. And because of our brains and the way they work, naturally so, because our most immediate context for the word slave is antebellum Southern slavery or the transatlantic slave trade, we automatically map our understanding of that word onto the Bible's use of the word slave. Sometimes the Bible does refer to someone who is actually owned as property as a slave or that idea of slavery. Other times, the word doesn't mean that. Just because the word is there doesn't mean it actually means that specific thing. We have this in every single language. There's a million words that mean two different things. If I say the word foot, what am I talking about? You have no idea. You're going to guess. I could be talking about a 12-inch span of distance or the things at the end of my legs. Now, if I give you context and I say my feet hurt or my foot hurts, now you know what I'm talking about. So context determines these things. The word slavery in the Bible, the word slave in the Bible is not always an insult. Now, Arabic, the language from which I hail, is a Semitic language, just like Hebrew. In fact, many of the words are exactly the same. Aramaic, same thing. There's a lot of them share the same exact roots. So my name in Arabic is very similar to the Hebrew word for slave. My name Abdu literally means his slave. When you see the word Abdullah, that literally means slave of God, or Abdul Rahman, the slave of the compassionate one, or the merciful or the beneficent one, Abdul Rahim, slave of the forgiving or the forgiving one. You know, there's all these different things in the Bible. You see this over and over again. Obed means the word for slave, or Oved. It kind of depends on how you pronounce it. Is the word for slave, and you see prophets named Obed all the time. You see an entire book of the Bible. Obadiah is slave. That's what it means. So it doesn't always mean an insult. It's considered an honorific. My name's considered honorable because I've attached myself to a cause greater than me or to a being who's higher than me. It's actually considered a voluntary thing oftentimes as well. And you find this in the Bible. So the Bible discusses or describes chattel slavery. It doesn't condone chattel slavery, owning someone as property. What it does is it does regulate, not require, but regulates indentured servitude. So the word slave can mean, and often does mean in the Bible, someone whose services are pledged to you or that you own because of a debt. The Bible describes it where someone is owned, not in the terms of their actually chattel, but just like, you know, the Pistons acquired thus and such from this team. We use this word now. In our so-called enlightened state, we're talking about acquiring people. But does anybody really believe that, you know, the Chicago Bulls acquired Dennis Rodman actually back in the day? No, it was his services, it was his skill, it was his basketball, skills and his contract. People did that all the time in the Old Testament. They acquired a person as a slave. They owned that person's services. Now, what's interesting about the way that works, actually, when you look at the specifics, jot and tittle of these things, and I won't go into every single passage, but I do go through it in the book. When you look at that stuff, what you'll see is that there are regulations that are so far different from Southern antebellum Southern slavery and the transatlantic slave trade that it's hard to believe that people actually equate these two things together. For example, in the South, there was the fugitive slave law, where if a slave escaped and you found a slave, and you didn't even own that slave or have anything to do with that slave, and you didn't return that slave back, you could be killed or at least fined heavily or imprisoned for not returning the runaway slave. The exact opposite happens in the Bible. If you find a runaway slave and you return him, you could be killed. You are required to keep that slave free. It's illegal in the Bible to kidnap somebody and force them into any kind of servitude. It's illegal. In fact, punishable by death. Every 7 years, regardless of whether or not the debt that they owe you has been paid off, every 7 years, you're required to let that slave and their family go free. And when you do let them go free, you're required, as the master of the debt, whether they paid it off or not, to let that servant go free, but also pay them liberally, the Bible says, liberally, from your property and your cattle and your money. Why? So that they never enter into servitude ever again. The Bible is rife with laws that are meant to regulate slavery and servitude out of existence. So there was no system of bankruptcy and debt. By the way, there's a good reason to believe that the 7 years of bankruptcy is borrowed from the Bible. Letting someone free of their debts. That's where it comes from. And by the way, also, if your 7 years isn't up, and it happens to be the year of Jubilee, you're required to let your slaves go. Even if they've been in slavery for 6 months or 6 minutes. Doesn't really matter. Let them go. And the Bible also says, by the way, don't try to avoid giving loans to people because Jubilee's coming up. You got to give them loans still so that people won't starve to death or whatever it is. So the Bible is not about perpetuating servitude. It's actually about ending servitude. And I can go on and on and on, but this really is no comparison whatsoever between what the Bible regulates and what human beings did with this whole thing. I don't know if you're aware of this, but you can go on to Amazon right now while you're sitting here and go buy yourself a slave Bible. You know what a slave Bible is? A slave Bible is a Bible that's been actually physically redacted, where the slavers, because they knew that once the slaves actually got a hold of a Bible, once they heard the gospel message, they'd hear all about Exodus, and they'd hear all about Paul's letters to various people. Philemon, for example, is a letter where Paul is negotiating the freedom of a runaway slave and says, whatever is charged to his account, charge it to me. I don't want him going back into slavery. You see it over and over again where Paul says, were you a slave when you were called? Don't let it bother you. But if you can, gain your freedom. There were all these admonitions Paul had and others had of like, try to gain your freedom. Slavery's not a good thing. We should be getting out of the system. All of that. And so what the slavers did was they took their Bibles. They knew that eventually the slaves would get a hold of this stuff, and they excised, they literally removed whole parts of it. The slave Bible has nothing of Exodus in it at all. No mention of Exodus. No even tangential years later references to the Exodus. Nothing of these liberation letters from Paul. None of this stuff about freedom and inherent human dignity. It's not in there. So here's the question. If the Bible was so pro-slavery, why did the slavers have to edit it at all? If it was pro-slavery, let them read it. See, God wants you a slave. But they had to edit it because it wasn't pro-slavery. Rather, what they did was they edited the words and then baptized their evil using Jesus. Now, someone might say, yeah, but there's still a lot of ethnic preferences. You know, the idea of ethnically preferring one people over another is prevalent in the Bible. God's chosen. You know, everybody else is awful, and only they're the good ones. And so God judges all these people because they're Canaanites, because they're Amalekites, because they're Anakites, because they're Assyrian, because they're Egyptian, because they're Babylonian. All these different ethnicities, they constantly get judged by God. Well, I want you to notice something. They weren't judged by God because of their ethnicity. That wasn't a part of it at all. Everyone looked the same over there, man. They're all sort of olive skin. They speak different languages, but they eat basically the same food, and they have the same accent. So it's not about that. It really isn't about that. Rather, what God was doing was using Israel as an instrument of judgment against various cultures for their horrible deeds, like child sacrifice to Molech, like temple prostitution, like all the marauding and pillaging they were doing, like the caravan raids, like idol worship, and all these terrible things they were doing. God used Israel as an instrument of judgment against those cultures, warned them ahead of time, by the way, you better stop what you're doing, lest you get judged, think Nineveh, and you think this whole all this stuff, if you stop it, you won't get destroyed. But if you continue, you're going to have problems. The Bible actually regulates this, and they continued, and God used Israel as an instrument of judgment against those various cultures because of their actions, not because of their skin color or because of where they lived. How do I know this is true, that it wasn't based on ethnicity? Because whenever Israel did the exact same things, God used Babylon, Assyria, Egypt, and others to judge Israel for the exact same things. It had zero to do with ethnicity and everything to do with character. It's as if God judges a person not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Does that sound familiar? Dr. King did not pull that out of the sky. Well, kind of, I guess. He got it from a biblical worldview. You know, you have this statement about the ought. Things ought to be a certain way. That, why ought they to be? If human beings are the deciders of who's valuable and who's not, then there is no ought. There's just what we say. But human beings have to aspire to this ought, to this moral center of the universe that says that people are not property. That's why Dr. King had said, "I refuse to accept the idea that the idols of man's present nature makes him morally incapable of reaching up for the eternal oughtness that forever confronts him." That eternal oughtness only makes sense if God exists. There is no eternal and there is no oughtness. So Martin Luther King's statements are based in a biblical worldview. What I want to suggest to you, friends, is that the racism we have to deal with today and we're struggling with today is being laid at the feet of evangelical Christianity or Christianity or the Bible itself. It doesn't matter what your denomination is. What I want to suggest to you is when you look at the way the Bible actually, and Jesus himself, treats people of different ethnicities, the Bible is actually the cure for the very things it's being blamed for. Let me suggest this. When you look at women now, I want to shift to women. And I'm going to use a particular story that's going to speak to both the gender issue and the race issue at the same time. Now, if the Bible was racist and sexist, what you would expect to see is none of the heroes, none of the good guys are non-Jews or women. If it was racist, only the Jews would be heroes. If it was sexist, only the men would be heroes. So let me give you a story where neither of those things is true. John chapter 4. By the way, one of my favorite chapters of the Bible. Every book I've ever written has John chapter 4 somewhere in it in detail. Because this story, I don't know what it is about this story. Maybe it's just me. But the depth of this story, the applicability of what happens at the woman at the well in John chapter 4 to the woman and through Jesus has this ability to transcend all these different barriers and stuff in a way that's so deep that I often sometimes think, how does anyone not realize this is coming from God and not from a handful of shepherds and fishermen? It's amazing to me. So you know the story. I won't recite it, but you know the story. I'll summarize the story, but I won't go to the Bible verses about it. So Jesus goes through Samaria, and the boys have to go off and get some stuff, food and whatever, and so they leave him there at Jacob's well. Now he's in Samaria. If you know anything about Samaria, you know that it's considered a genetic, ethnic, and religious half-breed society by the Jews. You're less than us, you're not us, you're, you know, sort of Babylonian mix and Assyrian mix and blah, 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 and all this stuff. And you don't even believe fully believe our religion. You believe in the God of Israel, but you don't really follow him. And so there's this whole thing. There's this ethnic issue. There's this land issue. Whose land is it exactly? Does that sound familiar? There's a religious thing. You're not really practicing the right religion. Does that sound familiar? I mean, all this stuff happening. It's the Middle East crisis, basically, in one chapter. So Jesus is standing there hanging out in Samaria, a place that Jews don't go because they look down on Samaritans, and that Samaritans hate the Jews for going there because the Jews look down on them. And so there's this mutual hatred now between these two ethnicities. And up walks a woman. She walks in the middle of the day. She comes to this well in the middle of the day by herself. That tells Jesus a whole lot about her. The first thing it tells her is that she's a reject, even amongst the rejects. Why? Because women didn't go to the wells in the middle of the day. Because it's hot and water is heavy. And you don't want to carry it back in the middle of the day. You go in the morning or you go in the evening. And you don't go alone for two reasons. One, social, just to be with other people. And two, safety. And here she comes by herself. So it tells him a whole lot about her situation. And he says, "Can I have a drink?" I love her response on this one in so many ways when she says, how is it that you, a Jewish man, a Jew from some, a Jew, ask me, a woman of Samaria, for a drink? How do you ask? What are you doing? Chip on her shoulders, pretty high, pretty big. You're a man, I'm a woman, you think less of me for that. I'm a Samaritan, you aren't thinking less of me for that. I can't get much lower than this in your eyes. And so she must have been thinking. She walks over to that well, and she's looking at this man. She's got to get the water. She walked all this way. And there's a guy sitting there. She's like, great, fantastic. Not only is the guy going to make me feel less than I am, but it's a Jewish guy at that. And she's surprised by who she finds. And he says, if you knew who was asking you, you would ask him for a drink, and he would give you, create you in you a well that springs up to eternal life. She doesn't quite get it at this point. She's still being a little too literal, and she says, where will you get this water from? For the well is deep. I want you to pause on this phrase for just a moment. The well is deep. I've gone to this story in four different books, five different books actually, speaking about this particular story and how valuable and how beautiful this story is and how multifaceted it is, and she's talking to the one from whom all the wells of eternal life spring. And she says, the well is deep. She has no idea how profound a statement she just made. And so what does he do? He begins to unmask her moral issues, you know, the things with the husbands and all that, most likely because, frankly, she's been abused and used and mistreated by these men. And she's living with a guy now. She's willing to live with the scorn of living with a guy that she's not her husband, and everyone knows it, just so that she can be safe. That's what she's got to go through. And he unmasks all her ethnic issues. Salvation is of the Jews. All her geographical issues. You know, you Jews worship in Jerusalem, but we Samaritans worship on the mountain. Mount Gerizim, by the way, that was in view of Jacob's well, where the temple in Mount Gerizim was destroyed at the time of them talking. So she could actually see the ruins of the temple that's been destroyed by the Jews. And the reason why the Jews destroyed the temple was because the Samaritans desecrated the temple in Jerusalem. So there's ethnic issues, there's geographical issues, there's, you know, all this stuff going on, all this. And he says, none of that matters. It's like, yep, you're a Samaritan woman. But I want to tell you something. God is not looking for people to worship him here or in Jerusalem or in the mountain or whatever it is. God is looking for those who worship him in spirit and in truth, because God is spirit. So he's telling her essentially, your ethnicity is not a barrier to your belief in God, nor is it a boulevard, by the way. It doesn't give you a sort of direct line to God. It's not important. It's not important. Rather, you, as a child made in God's image, are invited just as equally as anybody else is, whether you're a woman or you're a man or you're a Jew or you're a non-Jew. You're all invited equally. God so loved the world. She gets so excited by this message that she leaves her water jug there. Did you read that part in the Bible? She leaves it. And here's the part that really bakes my noodle. For whatever reason, she goes to the village of Sychar, a village that hates her, and doesn't think much of her, and for whatever reason, there's fire blazing in her eyes, there's something in her voice, there's something stirring up inside her where these people who don't think much of her believe her. And they go back, these Samaritans spend 3 days with a Jewish man they ought to hate. And they say to her, we no longer believe just because of your testimony, but we also now have seen and heard, and we believe this man is the Savior of the world. Ethnic unity where there should have been none. Gender unity where there should have been none. The first intercultural missionary in the New Testament era was a Samaritan woman. And the Bible is racist and sexist? It amazes me. One more on the women, and then I'm going to bring it to a sort of an end here. You look at a story. You know, and I recount several of these stories in the Bible. There are some stories in there where you don't always see the detail of what's going on. Two quick stories. One is not even a story. It's just an illustration of a point. The book of Esther, by the way, named after a woman. The book of Ruth, after a woman. You see these things in the Bible, right? Book of Esther starts off with this story, as you know. Essentially, Esther is this Jewish girl who becomes like a queen to the Persian king. And he needs a queen because the other one was disobedient, and so he got rid of her. He needs a new queen and all that stuff. The Bible could have started off with a story saying, and the king of Persia needed a new queen. And so he had a contest, essentially, to see who the queen should be. And Esther won, like Hadassah. She wins. Could have started off that way. It doesn't. Did you notice that? It doesn't. You know how it starts off? It starts off with Vashti, the Persian woman. She is the first person. She's beautiful beyond compare, et cetera, et cetera. And so the king has his boys have a gala. She has her own little party. And the boys are getting drunk. And he's like, well, you think your wives are hot? Bring my wife in. She's smoking hot. Let her parade around for a while. I got the best stuff and the best woman and all that. What does Vashti do? Nope. I'm not going to be your trophy wife. You can't disobey the king. And this woman has the dignity to risk everything to say, I will not be your property. She's a hero. You could have left that out. If you were a Jew who didn't care about Persians and their dignity, you could have left all that out. But they didn't. They included it because that's how it happened. And it was a worthy story to include because of a woman's dignity and her bravery and her passion. Then you go to a story all of us know. Mary and Martha. Sorry, Mary and Martha, you know. You know it well. The boys are coming over for dinner, you know, Jesus and the guys. And like good Middle Easterners, they want to make sure that everything's prepared and there's a ton of food and everything is clean and all this stuff. And Martha's a little more concerned than Mary is with the housework. And so Martha's doing her thing and she's working hard and Mary's sitting at Jesus' feet. She gets mad. She says, Jesus, she's, you know, not helping. And Jesus says, you know, Mary, you know, come and join us. You're not paying attention to the things of God, and you really should. Don't be so busy. So oftentimes in church, when we hear this story, we think, hey, this story is about, you know, not getting so busy in life that you miss out on an encounter with Jesus. You know, stop and smell the Messiah once in a while. You know, that kind of a thing. And that's true. That's fine. That's a good story here. That's a good part of the story. But here is the depth of this story. Here's the real depth. If you look at the studies of when women started to enter into the various fields that were traditionally male, engineering, sales, you know, these kind of things. In the 70s and the 80s, when women started to really make strides here, oftentimes they would go into an office where it was almost entirely male, and there was a lot of locker room talk and a lot of disgusting talk about women. And women had to be subject to that. They had to endure that junk, right? And in order to keep their job, they had to basically keep quiet. What ended up happening was, if another woman came into the work sphere, who wasn't just a secretary, but somebody else, the guys would actually take the focus off of her and put it onto the new one, and she was so glad that she was no longer the focus of this junk that she actually helped them go towards her and direct their junky talk towards her because they were so acculturated to, this is just the way it is. This is a woman's place. This is a woman's lot. They were just, that's the way it was. Eventually, they did find some solidarity together, but for the most part, that's the way it was because they had been swimming in the sewage of such misogyny for so long that they just got used to it. Now, take that framework, map it onto this story with Mary and Martha. So you know the story. Martha's doing the work. Mary's sitting at Jesus' feet, learning. That was not considered an insult to sit at someone's feet. It was considered an honor. Any male sitting at a woman's feet was considered an honored male, especially of a rabbi of Jesus' character and quality. So she sees Martha sees Mary doing this, and Martha gets upset because a woman's place is in the kitchen, not in the halls of learning. You read the rabbis, the leading rabbis of the time, of Jesus' time, and some of the most sexist things you'll ever hear in your life come from those people's pens about how women should not be learning anything. Kitchen or in front of a spindle. You can either make food or make clothes, and that's it, or make babies, and that's it. So Martha has been in this for a long time now, and she sees a woman break out of the mold, and she's incensed by it. And she says, Jesus, don't you care that she's left me to do all the work? Tell her to come and help me. Did you notice what she didn't do? She didn't say, Jesus, would you help me? Didn't occur to her to ask a man to help in the kitchen. So Jesus says to her, Martha, Martha, you're worried about many things, but only one thing is needful. Mary has chosen what is better, and it will not be taken from her. She exercised her free will, which she doesn't usually have, to get an education, which she's not ever going to get. And she did that in this context. And Jesus is saying, it won't be taken from her, not even by you, another woman. You're not going to put her in her place. In fact, your place isn't where you think you should be either. Come and sit down. In a culture that denied women the dignity of choice and certainly the dignity of an education, Jesus gave them both. And there's countless stories like this. Now, you know, time doesn't necessarily permit, maybe we can talk about it a little bit, but the sexuality issue is a really important one. When we look at this kind of thing, I think what's important for us to look at in terms of the sexuality question, it's not a matter of what the Bible says. That's pretty clear. Sexual expression is meant to be expressed only in the context of one man and one woman within the bond of marriage. That's clear. That's considered hateful. But here's the reason why we've done so such a bad job with this, is because we've told people what the Bible says. We haven't given them the reason behind why the Bible says it. And there's actually a beautiful reason why the Bible limits marriage between one man and one woman. You look at what the Bible is doing. You see this Hebrew Shema. You see the Shema, the Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Deuteronomy 6:4. When Jesus is asked, what's the greatest commandment? Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God, the Lord is one. Now, translated properly, that actually it says literally, Hear, O Israel, the Lord your God's, the Lord is unified. That's what it literally means. Because the word echad at the end, the Lord is one, is not for numerically one. It doesn't always have to mean that. It can mean unified. Like when the spies brought back the grapes, they brought an echad of grapes. They brought a unified cluster of grapes. When Adam and Eve become one flesh, it says, for this cause a man shall leave his father and mother, and the two shall become echad. Echad is unification of diversities. There is a unity of diversity in marriage. Marriage is a gift to you and me as one way, not the only way, but one way in which you and I can actually reflect the divine. A unity of diversities, male and female, both different in physical form, but also in psychological makeup and in the way we reflect God's image. Male and female, did he create them? In his image, did he create them, male and female? So a woman reflects God's image in a way that I do not. Because there's a femaleness, there's something about the way she does it that's different than me. And I reflect God's image in a way that she does not. And so when I substitute her out for someone who's just like me, I lose something. And so does the other person. They lose something in the transaction because we're supposed to reflect God's image, which is a unified diversity. That's the Trinity. And so you see this ability to reflect the divine and the unity of diversity of marriage. But fundamentally, here's the thing. Sex is a sacred act because the product it produces, a human being, is a sacred product. You are made in God's image. And if you can make sex into anything you want it to be, at any given time you want it to be that thing, it loses its sacredness. It loses its cohesion. It dissolves into a whatever. Men, you know this. One of the reasons why pornography addiction is so different than regular addiction. Look at the studies and you'll see this. Alcoholism, you just drink more alcohol. Yeah, it'll vary and that kind of thing, but really the drive for alcoholism is simply more alcohol. Drug addiction, yeah, you go into different levels and toxicities and various kinds of drugs to chase it high that you got the first time that you'll never duplicate again. But the result of drug addiction is simply more drugs. Pornography is different. Pornography addiction is not about more pornography, it's about different pornography. It gets weirder and weirder, or more and more outside the norm. You started watching pornography where you just looked at a single woman without clothes on. Then you started watching pornography where it was a man and a woman engaged in sexual action. Then it became different than that, and more heinous, more and more whatever it was. The reason why it becomes different, the reason why the old thing no longer satisfies is because you recognize somewhere, I think, in your mind and in your soul, you recognize that sex is sacred. And when you lose the specialness of sex, now you're chasing the specialness over and over again. And that same old thing that you've now desensitized yourself to no longer satisfies the specialness. So you go to the exotic, you go to the weird, you go to the fetishes, you go to all this stuff so that you can chase and get the sacredness back, only to realize you're never going to because you lost the original. And so why the Bible limits it this way is because God is not prohibiting something that's icky. And we dusty old men baptize their prejudices in these things because the Bible is protecting something beautiful. And I've told this to people over and over again at these universities when they come up to us and they talk to us and they want to know, and they're gay or lesbian or bi or trans or whatever it is, we talk to them about the beauty of the message. They can reject it, and that's fine. That's up to them. But it's our goal, friends, to live a sexual ethic that isn't heterosexual. That's not your goal, to be heterosexual. Your goal is to be holy sexual, to borrow from my friend Christopher Yuan. If homosexuality binds us to sin, heterosexuality blinds us to sin. And the goal is to be sexually pure, not in the sense of, you know, no blemishes and you can, once you screw up, that's it, it's over. Not that. It's to submit our sexuality to God and to get people to see that a biblical sexual ethic is not just a bunch of rules that some guys made up sometime, but that it's actually beautiful and it connects us with the divine. You know, I look at someone no less a luminary than Frederick Douglass. You know, when you look at the history of Frederick Douglass, do you know anything about this man? If you don't, you should. One of the best orators and writers in the history of America. This freed slave. Such a brilliant man that Abraham Lincoln, when he invited him to be on the stage during his second inaugural address. Abraham Lincoln, you know, the guy who wrote the Gettysburg Address, one of the most studied speeches in the history of the world. This orator of all orators, he invites Frederick Douglass onto the stage, this brilliant man, and afterwards he gets done with his inaugural address, which is brilliant, by the way, as well, and he turns to Douglass and he says, "Mr. Douglass, what did you think?" And Douglass says to him, "Mr. President, that was a noble effort." And Lincoln says back to him, "There's no one's opinion who's mattered more to me than yours." This brilliant man, if Christianity was racist and sexist and slavish and all these things, you would think that he would have seen it, this brilliant man who is familiar with it. And then he has the statement that's there in your outline for you. Between the Christianity of this land, meaning in the antebellum Southern slavery and even in white Northern America, between the Christianity of this land and the Christianity of Christ, I recognize the widest possible difference, so wide that to receive the one as good, pure, and holy is of necessity to be the enemy of the other. I love the pure, peaceable, and impartial Christianity of Christ. I therefore hate the corrupt, slave-holding, women-whipping, cradle-plundering, partial, and hypocritical Christianity of this land. Indeed, I can see no reason but the most deceitful one for calling the religion of this land Christianity. Today, people are saying Christianity is this white Western imperial religion that's meant to impose itself upon brown people and people and women. And then we look at Douglass and you say, what'd you think? You think he was fooled? Do you think this guy's a moron or something? He didn't see it? If he sees it as pure, peaceable, and impartial, maybe our current contemporaries could learn a thing or two from our elders and from some of the wisest folks to ever grace the soil of this land. It is good for the world. In fact, as I said before, Matthew Paris, it's in your outline in this section. I probably should have left it in this one for my oration, but the reality is Matthew Paris, this atheist from Africa, said that Christianity is what has blessed Africa far beyond. There's a reason Christianity is exploding in the global south and in Africa and in Egypt and in Iran and in China. It's not because of colonialism. That's long gone. It's because of the message. You are vessels of hope. You are vessels of beauty and truth and bravery. This is a world that thinks the Christian message is bad, and there's been lots of mess-ups by Christians. Believe me, I know. But I want to tell you this. This world needs this message that it's desperately running away from. But it might turn and say, you know what? I think I heard something worth responding to. Because that message came from somebody I admire. Friends, the credibility of the message is always judged by the integrity of the messenger. And you and I have a charge to be the kind of Christians who act in a way where a Zimmerman confronted by Yaakov might see something different. So I'll come back to that story as I finish. You heard the story. Zimmerman says, look, the whole hat, coat stealing thing, not going to work on me, man. I've suffered too much. Well, Yaakov wouldn't let it go. And the way he served them was to serve his family for 3 or something years. However many years it was, he served Zimmerman's family. And yes, he preached the gospel, but he also used his deeds to preach that gospel. And finally, Zimmerman bends his knee, gives his life to Christ, and he looks at Yaakov and said, I truly trust this Jesus, and my friend, you wear his coat well. I pray that each one of us wears his coat well. It's a tough job, but boy, is it worth it.